I got away before, and I can do it again. First lesson. He held up gold nipple clamps connected by a chain, but the clamps were the size of the thingy's mechanics connect to batteries to jumpstart cars. His face morphed into someone who looked like Grimshaw's nastier brother. That only lasted for a moment. As he leaned over me, smiling because I couldn't seem to move enough to get out of reach, his hair darkened, and the face, now lean and sculpted, had a thin scar beneath the left cheekbone. Then the gray eyes changed to melted chocolate brown as he settled the clamps over my big toes and said,
"Car?"
I snapped awake. My left arm had gotten tangled in the top sheet, securing me to the bed, creating the sensation of not being able to move. Jingle, jingle. I lifted my head off the pillow and looked at the crow perched on my big toes. The charm bracelet around its neck jingled as it wibble-wobbled on my toes, its nails digging in as it tried to maintain its balance. Aggie?
Caw.
Freeing myself from the sheet, I rubbed my hands over my face, and then whimpered because the area around my left eye was still living in the land of Ow. Could you get off my toes? I need to use the bathroom. Aggie hopped to the mattress. A jingle crow is not a stealthy crow. Then again, since she had access to purchased food and whatever was growing wild in the kitchen gardens that I hadn't had a chance to restore, maybe her meals didn't require any more stealth than mine did. I wobbled my way to the bathroom. I had a low-grade headache, and my stomach felt a little swoopy. Those might be symptoms of setting off the owl around my eye, but it was also my body's typical response when the weather turned so humid it felt like I was breathing water. That thought froze my brain for a moment. I turned on the bathroom lights and studied my neck carefully to make sure I hadn't acquired gills overnight. Of course, I hadn't eaten the strange food that was the only sustenance given to the plucky woman who had been abducted by the mysterious pirate who was taking her to his secret island. I carefully splashed cold water on my face and checked my neck again. Still gill-free. I made a note to myself that, for the next few days anyway, I should read a milder form of romance before bedtime. I returned to my bedroom to find Aggie exploring my jewelry box. I didn't have much that wasn't costume jewelry, and even the nicer pendants hadn't been worn in a while because the chains had knotted sometime during my move to an apartment in Hubney when Yorick and I first separated, and then to the jumble, and I couldn't seem to untangle them. Apparently, a crow's beak could do what human fingers couldn't. Aggie had worked out the knots on four of the necklaces and had laid them out on the dresser. Thanks. Maybe Pops Davies would have a jewelry box that would allow me to hang up some of these pieces. Just because I hadn't noticed something like that at the general store didn't mean Pops didn't carry it. Barely awake, and I was already tired and crabby and achy. The to-do list never seemed to get shorter. And if I didn't get into a routine to handle the day-to-day, I would never be able to handle having more than one lodger and provide them with amenities in the main house, to say nothing of providing some kind of cleaning service in the cabins. But I didn't have any other lodgers besides Aggie. I didn't count Conan and Cougar, because they weren't paying me anything to use the primitive cabins. Of course, I wasn't paying them for whatever they were doing around the jumble as a trade for the lodgings. Maybe I should ask what they were doing, besides blocking the access road, so that people couldn't just drive up to the main house. Cougar had been around every morning to watch me breathe and decide if I was still alive or now qualified as a snack. But I hadn't seen Conan, except for the storytime evenings. The bear showed up then in human form, but I had the impression that was the only time he wasn't seriously furry. Tired of working. Tired of worrying. Tired of thinking about why someone who might or might not be Yorick wanted the jumble enough to cause so much trouble. I grabbed my bathing suit and went into the bathroom to change. Sure, Aggie was a girl, and she was so engrossed in discovering what else might be tangled in my jewelry box, it wasn't likely she would even notice if I changed out of my nightie. But I had a full load of body image issues, so being seen by someone else did matter to me. I put on the bathing suit, a little surprised that it fit a wee bit better than it had a couple of weeks ago. Pulling on a beach cover-up, I returned to the bedroom and found my sandals next to the bed. I studied the golden-haired pirate on the cover of the romance novel I'd been reading last night. Yep, could have been Grimshaw's less trustworthy brother. So not something I was going to mention to the large police officer, who had a gun and handcuffs and already thought I was a pain in his ass. Teasing Grimshaw would be like rolling up a newspaper and whacking Cougar over the head. I would expect the results to be pretty similar. I packed two beach towels into my big woven bag, along with a bottle of water and a smaller bottle of juice. I also stuffed one of the Alan Wolfgard novels into the bag's pocket. Then Aggie and I left the house. She flew off, and I went down to my private beach. Some of the shoreline that was part of the jumble was stony, but a long stretch nearest to the house was sand. I had been meaning to ask if that was typical of the Finger Lakes, but in the end I didn't care. It was a pleasant place to walk, even when the water was too cold for swimming, and I had a feeling someone had done some work to make this beach as nice as it was. I spread one towel, anchoring it with the woven bag. I put the cover up in the bag and used the sandals as a second anchor. Then I walked down to the water, letting it wash over my ankles. It was still early enough in summer for the water to be cold, but you could go out a few yards before the gradual slope turned into a steep drop-off, and the shallow water felt more like a refreshingly cool shower. So I waded in up to my knees, then my thighs. Finally, I lifted my legs and tipped back into the water, spreading my arms as the water covered everything but my face, and my hair floated around my head. The water felt delicious. Every so often, I kicked my feet and used my hands to steer. Every so often, I righted myself and touched bottom to confirm I hadn't slipped into deep water. Finally, starting to let go of all the various worries, I closed my eyes and enjoyed the water. Then, a hand touched my shoulder, gently pushing it down. My body turned with the push, and I went under. I came up sputtering and scared because I hadn't heard anyone enter the lake. Planting my feet in the sand, I shoved my hair away from my face and got ready to blast the person who had no business being there. Then, I got a good look at her. From the hips up, she was water, shaped like a human female. I knew she was water because I watched minnows leaping out of her torso, creating little splashes as they returned to the lake. She had a delicate build, slender and sinuous. She had webbing between her fingers. She had dark eyes, but I couldn't tell if the eyes came from another Terra Indigene form she could assume or were formed from shadows. Even her hair was water, but it was the color of shale. "Don't you like my lake?" If the sound of water murmuring over sand could be shaped into words, that was her voice. "Yes, I do," I replied. "It's a lovely lake." "But you remain anchored to the land." She didn't seem upset, more curious about my behavior. "I know how to swim, but I'm not a strong swimmer. Not yet, anyway. So I feel more comfortable swimming the length of the beach and being able to touch bottom rather than swimming into deep water." I didn't mention the potential danger of being struck by a rowboat or canoe, or that the deeper water was still too cold for a human to be in for any length of time. She might understand the danger of being struck, but I didn't think water temperature would mean much to her. "I'm Vicky."
"I know. You are the land's caretaker now."
I waited, but she didn't offer a name. Maybe she didn't have one humans could pronounce. Maybe she assumed her identity was obvious.
Inike, do you know Inike? And I were talking about doing some trail ride beach parties for her boarders and my lodgers. Would it be okay with you if other humans came swimming at this beach?
Why do you ask?
Well, I waved an arm toward the center of the lake, my fingertips trailing in the water. This is your home. We're guests. She smiled, clearly pleased that I understood.
Your guests will be my guests.
Then she raised a hand and looked stern.
But no motor things.
No motor things. Since we were chatting, it was my chance to ask. Why no motors? Do they spoil the water?
Some elders live in the northern end of the lake, but they hunt the length and breadth of my home. The sound of the motor things is the sound of both prey and challenger, and the sound annoys them. So they will attack even if they are not hungry.
Oh, golly. What about the way humans splash around when they're swimming? Sharks are attracted to that sound because it sounds like a fish in distress. At least that's what I've read. She laughed.
There are no sharks or shark guard in the Feather Lakes.
She thought for a moment before adding,
the elders in the lake are smaller than many of the old forms of Terra Indigene, but they are fast and fierce. However, they do not attack humans who behave as guests, unless those humans enter their home water at the northern end of the lake.
The elders in the lake might be smaller, but there was at least one form of Terra Indigene living in the jumble that was big enough to pick up a grown man and twist him. How big was the biggest elder living in the lake? And what were we talking about? Something that looked like an alligator, but was big enough that it could ram a motorboat? And what about the smaller ones? Were they dog size? People size? And if they did get hungry, just how fast could a human be consumed? My brain stuttered. Was that a minnow trying to nibble on my ankle or something else? I focused on my companion. It was like watching water ebb and flow in a human-shaped container. She watched me as if I was the most entertaining thing she'd seen in quite a while. I wondered if that was true.
Vicky? Vicky!
I turned toward the shore.
That's my friend Inike. Would you like to meet her?
Not today. She sank to the waist. Then the human shape rose on a column of water, like one of those leaping game fish. As she reached the apex of the leap and headed down, her shape dissolved until only a spray of sun-sparkled water met the rest of the lake. I stumbled out of the water, stopping where the wet sand changed to dry and hot sand.
Vicky?
Inike's voice sounded worried.
Here!
She appeared a minute later.
I thought you might be cooling off. It's a good day for it. And, gods, what happened?
She led me to the towel, dug in my bag, and opened the bottle of juice.
Drink some of this. You're white as a sheet.
I just met the Lady of the Lake. Inike stared at me.
What's she like?
Watery, and quite nice. I drank some of the juice. She has no objections to our beach days, as long as we give her home the same care and respect as our own. Inike took the juice and drank some, before giving the bottle back to me.
Sounds fair.
I leaned toward her.
She said elders live in the lake.
Their home is the northern end of Lake Silence, but they hunt in and along the whole of the lake, and they're the ones who don't like things with motors.
Then we should be safe enough,
she eyed me.
Right?
Right. But the next time I went to Let Us Read, I was going to see what books Julian had about alligators and ancient freshwater predators, just in case. Chapter 34. Grimshaw. Sunday, June 20th. Pulling into the truck stop, Grimshaw parked next to the other police car and sat for a minute. He still worked for Captain Hargreaves, was still on the Bristol payroll as a highway patrol officer, since his stint in Sproing was a temporary assignment. So he had to wonder why he wasn't being asked to report to the Bristol police station, instead of his captain going off the clock to meet him here, because he was sure Hargreaves had taken personal time instead of officially meeting one of his officers. Grimshaw slid into one side of the booth and set his hat and a manila envelope on the seat.
Captain? This.
Hargreaves broke off and smiled at the waitress, who hustled up to their table. He ordered the steak sandwich special and iced coffee. Grimshaw ordered the same to save time.
This should have been an easy assignment, Hargreaves said. A human killed by one of the Terra Indigene? It's unfortunate, but everything points to the man being seen as an intruder. Should have been easy, but that death turned over a rock, and a lot of nastiness has crawled out.
Grimshaw picked up the envelope and slid it across the table.
My report. Didn't want to send it by email.
While Hargreaves read the report, Grimshaw stared out the window. Vicky Devine should be safe in the jumble. A sharpshooter might set up across the lake, or on the water, and try for her when she went for a swim. But it would be a suicide mission, because he didn't think anyone could get away fast enough once the shot was fired. But Julian? Someone could walk into Let Us Read and open fire. If the attack was timed right, he and Osgood wouldn't be nearby, and no one else would take on an armed man. No one human, anyway. Hargreaves tucked the report back in the envelope and set the envelope under his own hat.
I heard that Swin is taking personal time. So is Reynolds. What does that mean?
It means they can spend time in Sproing without having to explain themselves to their own captain.
If they break the law, I'll toss their asses in a cell until you can arrange for them to be transferred to the Bristol lockup.
Hargreaves smiled again when the waitress brought their meals. The smile faded as soon as she walked away.
It was easy enough to request Swin's and Reynolds' transcripts from the police academy. Both men attended the academy in Hubney, but not at the same time. There is almost a decade between them in age. Finding out about the other men.
Shrugging, he picked up his sandwich and took a big bite.
If this does have its roots in some kind of club or organization that these men joined while they were at school, there's no way to tell if you're asking for help from someone who might be part of the scheme, Grimshaw said.
The steak sandwich looked good, but he didn't have much appetite. I made a roundabout inquiry into the other men, where they went to school, that sort of thing, Hargreaves said. The request will reach an agent in the governor's investigative task force.
Who might have a special tie clip. Doubt it. The agent is Governor Hannigan's nephew, and is trusted by the Terra Indigene. If anyone can make inquiries without sounding any alarms, it's him. In the meantime, I'll maintain order in a town that is so small its main street doesn't have a single stoplight, and yet has been as much trouble as a tavern brawl on a Water's Day night.
Grimshaw bit into his sandwich. Which would be worse, being responsible for a friend's survival, and possibly failing, or someday picking up a newspaper and reading about Julian Farrow's murder? No contest. Being nearby was the only way to succeed. Hargreaves drank half his iced coffee.
I'll apologize for sticking you with this assignment, if that makes you feel better. But, Wayne...
Consider what might be happening in Sproing right now if someone connected to Swin and the rest of them had answered that call for assistance instead of you. Chapter 35 Them Sunday, June 20th Useless, incompetent dickheads. How could so many of them screw up something so easy and get killed on top of it?
The bitch is still there, still in control of our asset, he told the other three men.
He didn't look at the dick his cousin had married, the fool who had tossed the property away in the first place.
Once they had control of the property, he would find a way to cut the asshole out of the deal. And wouldn't his cousin bust the fool's balls over that? Served her right for not choosing someone who was top tier.
What are we going to do?
The oldest man asked.
What we should have done in the first place.
He smiled.
Take care of it ourselves.
Chapter 36. Vicky. Water's Day, June 24th. It rained for 2 days. All the green things needed the rain, and even the rain barrels that collected water from the downspouts had been close to empty. So while I didn't complain, not out loud anyway, the initial storm taught me how isolated I would have been at the main house if I'd been on my own. Which I wasn't. But I can't say with any honesty that wet panther or wet bear smells any better than wet dog. When the storm rolled in across the lake on Thursday evening, I'd been at the renovated cabins, giving the two unoccupied ones a quick dust and vacuum, and helping Aggie change the sheets on her bed. We gathered up the sheets and towels and stuffed them into large carry sacks. Then I saw the flash of lightning and heard the boom of thunder. We went out on Aggie's porch.
The elementals are playing, Aggie said.
She stepped closer to me.
Or they're angry about something.
Flash. Boom!
What makes you think the elementals are doing this?
It's just a storm.
Thunder and lightning are running together.
Flash. Boom! Aggie looked toward Silent's Lodge, which was hidden behind a wall of rain making its way across the mile-wide lake.
And Ilya Sanguinati says if you don't leave for your house now, you should plan to stay in the cabins here until the storm quiets.
How long will that take? She shrugged. There wasn't any food in the unoccupied cabins, and I wasn't sure if Aggie had anything stored, or if what she had was something I, being human, would want to eat for any reason short of desperation.
Flash. Boom!
That spear of lightning struck the lake. I'm going to make a run for it. I looked at Aggie, who carefully didn't look at me. Where were her kin? Would they join her here, to huddle on the porch, somewhat protected from the weather? Or did they already have their own shelters? If you want to come with me, stuff a couple of changes of clothes in a bag and do it fast.
And remember to bring your toothbrush,
I shouted when she dashed into the cabin. The storm seemed to stall over the lake for a few minutes, long enough for Aggie to pack and make sure the cabin's windows were closed. She didn't lock the door, and I didn't comment. After all, if she wanted to let her kin have use of the cabin during the storm, I wasn't going to be mean about it. I had left the door of the screened porch unlatched, and I was glad because someone had kept the storm on a tight rein just long enough for us to reach the porch. Then it came thundering over the jumble. I unlocked the kitchen door and dumped the carry sacks.
Close the windows,
I said, as I ran around the house doing exactly that. Not fast enough in some cases. The wind scattered papers in my office, knocked over a lamp in another room, and soaked the curtains in a couple of rooms. Breathless, I ran back to the kitchen and pulled out the sheets and towels, handing the hand towel and face cloth to Aggie. These need to be washed anyway, so let's use them to wipe up any water on the windowsills and floor. She didn't ask questions, didn't indicate if this was a familiar human behavior or a new experience.
Flash. Boom!
The weatherman on the TV news had talked about a storm coming in from the west that could be fierce enough to cause some flooding and close roads. Viewers had been warned to have emergency lanterns and food for a couple of days in case they were cut off from nearby towns. I had assumed the warning was for the farmers and vintners, but I suddenly realized the warning was also meant for someone like me. And I was glad that Aggie had chosen to join me at the main house. When I returned to the porch to see if I'd left anything that could be damaged by water, I found a wet cougar and equally wet Conan waiting for me by the kitchen door. They were in their furry forms, and each carried a sack that I assumed contained some human clothes. I stepped aside in invitation. Aggie is here, too. Do you want to join us? They entered the kitchen and dropped their sacks next to the ones Aggie and I had carried from her cabin. They came back out with me while I did a quick check of the porch. Since the porch ran the length of the house, a quick check to rescue a couple of books and move a couple of plants from tables to the floor wasn't all that quick, and I was clothes clinging wet by the time I returned to the kitchen. Conan and Cougar had tipped over the lightweight chairs on the porch, an activity I appreciated when a blast of wind knocked me into Conan. I wasn't sure the bear even noticed. I was pretty sure I would have some interesting bruises the next day. I couldn't wait to explain those to the doctor, or Ilya Sanguinati, or Officer Grimshaw. It wasn't my fault. The wind knocked me into a bear. I wasn't sure Dr. Wallace would want to believe me. After all, he was one of the Sproing residents who had lived in the safe little bubble of believing the others were out there before the events of the past few days had shown everyone that out there really meant right here. I went to my suite and changed into dry clothes. I looked at my hair and put enough clips in it to hold it away from my face, planning to take a hot shower later and use extra hair conditioner in the hope of combing out all the tangles. When I returned to the common rooms, Cougar and Conan had shifted to human form and were dressed. They still smelled a bit like wet animal, but I decided not to comment about that, since it occurred to me that I had no idea what a wet human might smell like to them. On Fire's Day, the first full day of rain, I made hourly checks of the rooms, reassuring myself that I hadn't left a window open or had any leaks that I could ill afford to have fixed at the moment. One of my companions came with me during each inspection, watching everything I did, but not asking why I needed to check something I'd already checked. They just rotated, keeping me company. In between inspections, we napped or read. I turned on the TV to watch the noon news. Serious faces advising viewers to stay indoors as much as possible. Some flooded roads, some blocked by downed trees.
Why do humans need other humans to tell them things they should be able to know by themselves? Conan asked.
There is comfort in confirmation, I replied. It's easier to believe something if someone else thinks the same thing. They looked at the windows as the wind chose that moment to drive the rain against the house with enough force it sounded like pebbles hitting the glass. Then they looked at me.
It's raining, Cougar said solemnly. If you go outside, you will get wet.
I wasn't sure if he was trying to be snarky or helpful, but I decided to go with helpful.
That's what I think, too.
He nodded, yawned, then closed his eyes as he stretched out on the floor. I studied him. Could he really fall asleep that fast? Conan was also dozing. Even Aggie was curled up at one end of the sofa, looking too young to be on her own. Then again, a lot of her kin might live in the jumble. So her staying here probably wasn't much different from a human teenager going away to college. I'm going to take a shower. Three pairs of eyes opened, fixed on me for a moment, then closed again. Going upstairs to my suite, I stripped out of my clothes, turned on the shower to bring up the hot water, and hesitated as I listened to the storm. I hadn't heard a rumble of thunder or seen a flash of lightning in a while. I wasn't keen to become a morbid headline, woman struck by lightning while taking a shower, but I thought I would be safe if I was quick. Warmed by the shower, I combed through my hair and wondered if I should try the hairstylist in Sproing, an old barber who had a monopoly on the haircutting trade because he hadn't run away or been eaten last summer, or take Inike's advice and go to the stylist in Crystalton who cut and colored her hair. Someone who, according to Inike, had an extra sense about how to do the most with the hair a person had. Then I thought about the income that wasn't coming in and wondered if I wanted to throw away money on a lost cause. So not something I would say to Inike, who would give me a lecture about letting someone else's opinion sour my opinion of myself. Easy for her to say. Feeling a bit defiant, or maybe just not caring for the moment, I pulled on clothes that were comfortable and warm, and in no way flattering, things I wouldn't wear around anyone human. Then I thought about Aggie's questions about what to wear and when to wear it, and changed into clothes that were a little less disreputable. Not being happy with the way I looked, or any of the clothes in my closet, didn't mean I had any right to spoil Aggie's fashion adventure. As I returned to the social room, it occurred to me that Paige Xavier had the same light-boned build as Aggie, if not the same coloring, and might be better at suggesting outfits suitable for the Crow. If the weather cooperated, we would have our first trail ride beach party in a few days, and I could introduce Aggie to Paige and let them work things out for themselves. The rest of Fire's Day passed quietly. We read our own books. I thawed out all the meatballs in the freezer and made spaghetti and meatballs for dinner, which was a new food for the boys and required teaching them how to twirl the spaghetti on a fork. Since that slowed down food consumption, I suspected that, on their own, they would have picked up the spaghetti by the handful and ignored the saucy mess. But they were sufficiently intrigued in learning how to eat this meal the human way that they persevered, and in the end, everyone had plenty to eat. By Water's Day afternoon, the novelty of staying inside napping and reading had worn off, even for me. I opened the cupboard where I had stored board games and the shoeboxes filled with plastic figures I had purchased as toys for the children of my future guests. I dismissed the jigsaw puzzles as being too sedate, even if the four of us worked on one together. I dismissed the games that were too young for my companions. Finally, I pulled out a box and held it up to show Aggie and the boys. Let's play murder. I tried not to think too long or too hard about the way all their eyes brightened and the amount of enthusiasm they showed as we set up the game. They looked a little puzzled as I explained the game, but they recognized the fireplace poker, rope, revolver, knife, and hammer as weapons. I had to explain the garrote. Teeth would work better to choke your prey, Conan said, studying the game piece. Yours, maybe. Mine, not so much. Could you garrote a bear or panther? Could someone get a wire around a neck and through all that fur fast enough not to get clawed to pieces? Another question to ponder when I couldn't fall asleep. I let each of them fan a different set of cards while I selected victim, weapon, and location, and tucked them in the little envelope. Then I shuffled all the cards and dealt them. Now we have to figure out who died and... Aggie, Conan, and Cougar immediately laid down the character cards they were holding, then looked at me. Do you have any humans? Aggie asked. I revealed my character card. Now we know which human is dead, Conan said. But we still need to figure out where that human died, I said. They laid their location cards over the rooms on the game board and looked at me again. I put my location card over the kitchen, which left the dining room as the only location uncovered. I held up a hand before the three of them could put down the weapon cards. To make it more interesting, let's say that a player has to fetch a weapon and bring it to the dining room, and if a person has the card to show that weapon wasn't used, he or she only shows it to that one player. Needing to roll dice and move their pieces along the squares to reach a room suddenly added more interest to the game. Since even Aggie was more of a predator than me, I didn't point out that I had explained the rules before we had started, so the whole thing would have been more interesting if we were trying to figure out the who, what, and where instead of just the what. Even then, the Terra Indigene didn't seem to understand that every player worked alone. Maybe that was something I should mention to Officer Grimshaw. They might not cooperate if one brought down a deer and wanted to keep his lunch for himself, but when it came to finding a human who did a bad thing, they scattered and regrouped. Each of them clumped over the board to reach the closest room with a weapon, and then they headed for the dining room, taking the weapon with them. Since I was considered part of this odd pack, I followed their example and fetched the knife that had been in the kitchen, leaving the garrote that had been discarded there. Maybe it would have been a weapon of opportunity in a crime show. Not a likely weapon, since I didn't think most people knew how to kill someone with a garrote. You probably had to go to assassin school or something and take the garroting class to learn how to do it properly. Which didn't mean someone couldn't do it badly, but still be effective in the end. I think they all figured out the knife was the weapon, but they all guessed incorrectly, letting me reveal the final piece of evidence.
That was pretty good,
Cougar said, making me think he would offer a cub the same encouragement for almost catching a bunny or some other small edible.
Yes,
Conan agreed.
But our way of playing the game is better.
You all play a different version of murder? I asked. They nodded. I considered making an excuse to stay in my suite for a few hours. Then I considered that this was good practice for entertaining lodgers on a rainy day. Not that I would be expected to play games with my lodgers. I would be expected to provide drinks and snacks and fight with the rabbit ears that provided sketchy TV reception in this kind of weather, since there was bound to be someone who preferred television over board games. Why don't you set things up for your version of the game, while I see what I can rustle up for snacks? That suggestion went over well and gave me an excuse to retreat for a few minutes. I was pondering what I had available that would feed two carnivores and two omnivores when the phone rang. The jumble, Vicky speaking.
It's Julian. How are you doing out there?
Since I'm not planning to leave until I run out of food or the rain stops, I'm doing pretty well. Aggie, the boys and I are about to play the Terra Indigene version of murder.
Oh.
A single word, followed by the slightest pause.
Well, I'm glad you're not on your own there in the storm.
Something in his voice. It suddenly occurred to me that Julian might be lonely. He lived in one of the Mill Creek cabins, but he was the only tenant. That meant he was as isolated there as I was at the jumble. Of course, if the roads were passable and he could reach the village, he could rent one of Inike's rooms for a night to avoid being alone. I don't know what the main roads are like, or if my access road is passable, but if you'd like to join us... I did have two guest suites on the second floor of the main building, so I could offer him a place to stay instead of going out on slick roads after dark. And since I'd already said Aggie and the boys were here, he wouldn't mistake the offer as more than an invitation for friendly company.
I'd like that. Is there anything I can pick up, since I can stop at Pop Store before I leave Sproing?
You're already in the village? Are you sure you want to come out in this weather?
I'm sure.
I wasn't sure I would brave the roads today for anything less than an emergency, but I took him at his word and considered what I was going to run out of by tomorrow morning. Bread, milk, sandwich fixings?
Got it. I'll see you in a little while.
The larder was a little more bare than I'd thought, even for snacks. I cut up some carrots, cut some cheddar cheese into squares, and made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I add the jar of sweet pickles, but put them back, unopened. There were good reasons why, unlike Inike, I didn't include meals with the cabin rentals. Or with the suites upstairs, for that matter. Use of the kitchen? Yes. Me putting out more than snacks? Not a chance. Since Aggie and the boys were more of a mind to eat whatever was available, and hadn't yet acquired any discernment about what foods were a good or bad combination, they were quite happy with what I brought out. I hadn't been gone that long, but they had rummaged through all the supplies and toys I had purchased and had transformed the murder game. The original board was in the center of the table, but the rooms now had labels that matched the downstairs rooms in the jumble, even if the layout couldn't match.
they had taken sheets of colored construction paper and added green woodland on three sides of the board. On the fourth side, they had snugged three little houses together to represent the lakeside cabins, added a strip of tan paper to represent the beach, and, finally, blue paper to represent the lake. Aggie was busy making strips of squares that matched the size of the squares on the board, while Conan carefully secured the strips to the construction paper to indicate paths into the woods and paths from the kitchen down to the cabins in the lake. Cougar had found the sets of little plastic toys and created a cluster of trees on each of the green sheets of paper. There were farm animals, cow, pig, chicken, horse, scattered on the papers, positioned next to squares. There were also foxes, hawks, owls, a family of deer, and a moose. And there was a wolf and a coyote. The bear, cougar, and crow were set on three of the places where players started the game. As for the people,
"Look!"
Aggie beamed at me as she paused in her square making to hold up a figure in a police uniform.
"It's a teeny Grimshaw, and here is a teeny Vicky."
They were plastic figures that had come out of molds. They had no relevance to the real world. It still gave me a thrill to see that Teeny Vicky was just as tall as Teeny Grimshaw. Teeny Vicky was also placed on the game board in a starting position. Teeny Grimshaw was in the library. I had no idea why. Other teeny people included a dark-haired man dressed in casual business attire that made me think of Julian. There was a man in a white coat with a stethoscope around his neck, and a woman in a nurse's uniform. There was a woman wearing an apron, like a short-order cook. There was a curvy, dark-haired woman in a business suit, and a man in a business suit. Except for Teeny Grimshaw, the other people were placed on the edges of the board, as if they weren't part of the game yet. Except for the woman in the long blue dress who was placed in the center of the blue paper that represented the lake. I didn't have to ask who she was. But there was one other creature on the board. I put down the tray of snacks and picked up one of my fuzzy white socks. It had been stuffed with a partial roll of toilet paper. The sock now had frowny eyes drawn on with a permanent black marker, as well as a mouth full of a ghastly number of teeth, and arms that ended with paw hands that had serious claws.
"What is this?" I asked.
"That's the elder,"
Aggie said, taking it from me and replacing it on the board. I would never be able to wear that sock without either stepping on an elder or looking down and seeing that face looking up at me. Besides the die that was rolled for movement, there was another pair of dice that, I was told, was used for a number of things. And there was a small stack of cards made from index cards that had been cut in half. Since those were turned over and placed in the center of the board where the envelope with the answers usually resided, they weren't part of the human version of the game. Then again, neither were the question marks that were randomly placed on some of the squares, both on the board and on the newly created paths. We had our snacks while Aggie and the boys finished making the pieces for their version of the game. I took the dishes back to the kitchen and returned to the social room with a pitcher of cold water and several plastic glasses.
"We're ready to play,"
Aggie said. Cougar wrinkled his lips, revealing his mismatched teeth, and said,
"Heh, heh, heh, heh."
Oh, golly, did I really want to play a game that made Cougar that gleeful? I gave them my brightest smile.
"All righty, let's..."
I heard a car pull up and headed for the front door. That must be Julian. I heard two car doors close, then two more, and hesitated. Maybe that wasn't Julian. Maybe it was someone else. Someone who thought I would be alone here. I was aware of Conan coming up behind me and Cougar moving past me toward the front door. The doorbell rang. Chapter 37. Grimshaw. Watersday, June 24th. Grimshaw glanced in the rearview mirror at the two bags of groceries and the three large pizzas filling up the back seat of the cruiser before focusing on the wet road.
You expecting Vicky Devine to live on pizza for the next few days?
Or few weeks?
She said Aggie and the boys were staying with her during the storm.
Julian replied.
I wanted to make sure she had enough food in the house.
He wasn't sure pizza would be the best choice of food for a bear and panther, but he didn't argue. Besides, he liked pizza.
I could have taken my own car, Julian said. This one handles better on wet roads.
Julian said nothing for a minute.
Were you worried about her too?
It was his turn to choose his words.
Not worried as such, but I've been patrolling the village since the storm hit to make note of any flooded streets or down power lines.
And giving quiet thanks last night that he wasn't one of the highway patrol officers driving those dark roads in the wild country in this weather.
The jumble and its residents are also part of my territory, so it was time to check up on them. And to show the Terra Indigene that human authority isn't ignoring someone they've taken an interest in? That too.
He turned onto the access road to the jumble. Someone had removed the chain across the road. Had one of the boys, as Vicky Devine called them, come out to do it? Or had it been down a while, maybe indicating that someone else had gone up to the main house?
Julian, we're not walking into anything, Julian said after a long moment.
Then he would assess the situation and decide if he should mention the chain to Conan or Cougar. After all, they were the ones who had put it up in the first place. They got out of the car. Julian grabbed the three pizzas, and Grimshaw grabbed the two bags of groceries. They closed the car doors and ran for the overhang protecting the front door. Julian juggled the pizzas and managed to ring the doorbell. When the door opened, it wasn't Vicky Devine standing there to greet them. It was Cougar, and he didn't look like greeting them was what he had in mind.
We brought pizza, Julian said.
Hi, Julian,
Vicky said brightly, peering around Cougar.
You're just in time.
She hesitated for a moment.
Officer Grimshaw.
Hope it's all right for me to stop by,
he said. He wasn't in uniform, and had left Osgood on call for the evening.
Oh, sure.
Vicky tapped her fingers against the panther's arm.
Cougar, let them come in out of the rain.
They followed her to the kitchen, and Conan and Cougar followed them. He listened to Vicky and Julian wrangling about the cost of the groceries and paying for the pizzas while he put the milk and orange juice into the refrigerator. He noticed the others were also listening to the wrangling, but neither male was showing any further sign of hostility toward Julian. Vicky paid for her groceries and accepted the pizzas as Julian's contribution for a social evening. Grimshaw took note that Conan and Cougar knew enough about the main house to know where to find the dishes, glasses, and flatware. They piled pizza onto the plates, took plenty of napkins, and went into the social room. Vicky and Julian went back for the glasses and a pitcher of water. Grimshaw would have preferred a beer, but he was driving, and it wasn't a night to have his reflexes even slightly dulled. Then they all looked at the Terra Indigene's version of murder, and Grimshaw watched Julian Farrow pale.
It's the jumble,
Julian said, sounding as if he were choking. To give Julian time to recover before anyone started asking questions, Grimshaw pointed to what he hoped was a clean sock and said,
What's that?
Fuzzy sock, Elder, Vicky replied.
Crap. He ate pizza and listened to the others explain their version of the game. Land on a question mark, and you pick a card that might allow you to take an extra move or allow you to escape a predator. Or be attacked by one. The pair of dice were thrown to decide conflicts. An even number meant the player entering the room would not attack the player already in the room. An odd number equaled an attack, and the number itself determined the severity of the attack.
A low number indicated a small, non-lethal bite, while a high number equaled being eaten or at least desperately injured unless you had a doctor card and could get help, or had a friend card that meant the other player would now work with you instead of munching on you. No way to get out of playing now, so he resigned himself to losing the game and reminded himself that he'd gotten Pete's out of the deal, and hoped he wasn't really seeing the signs that Julian was sensing something terribly wrong now. They agreed on the rules. The initial victim was a character from the original game. The weapon would be one of the human ones that came with the game, and the location would be one of the rooms on the board. But the others insisted that they had to play by Miss Vicky's rule that you had to bring the weapon to the room to make your guesses, which would have been fine, except Grimshaw noticed almost all of the weapons had been scattered in the north, south, and east woods. The revolver was in the lake, placed on the last square located on the blue paper. Six weapons, six players. They rolled the die and moved their pieces on the squares to reach one of the two doors that would get them outside to fetch the weapons.
"I could go out a window,"
Aggie said after rolling a two for the third time.
"I'm a crow. I could do that."
"No squares under the windows," Vicky said. "You can't move your piece except on the squares, so you have to reach a door." Julian moved Teeny Julian out the kitchen door and headed for the lake and the revolver. Teeny Vicky went out the front door and headed for the garrote in the north woods. Teeny Cougar headed for the rope, but got distracted when he landed on a square and had the chance to eat a fawn. He didn't roll a number high enough for a serious injury, so the fawn got away, and he growled softly about the missed kill until Vicky went into the kitchen and returned with the rest of the pizzas, much to Grimshaw's relief, since he was sitting next to the panther. They were still wandering outside, retrieving the weapons, when Grimshaw felt the first ripple of unease. Julian had been heading for the lake during his turns and had rolled a six, enough to reach the last square on the blue paper and get the revolver. Except Julian moved his piece to the last square on land and stopped. He stared at the lake and the female in the blue dress for so long that Vicky started to reach out and touch his arm. Then Julian turned his playing piece around and marched Teeny Julian back toward the house.
"But you didn't fetch the revolver," Vicky said.
"No," Julian replied, beads of sweat popping up on his forehead. "He's afraid," Grimshaw thought. "What is he sensing that would make him afraid? It's just a game." Could this game version of the jumble be just close enough to represent the real thing? He'd never seen Julian react this way when they'd been in the academy. Grimshaw landed on a question mark square and drew a friend card, meaning when he finally entered a room or confronted a predator, he could use the card instead of rolling the dice to determine the outcome of a fight. Vicky also landed on a question mark square. "Help from an elder," she read. She looked at the fuzzy sock guarding the north woods and smiled. "That's a good card."
"Yes," Aggie said, not smiling. "It's a very good card. You should keep it with you."
Grimshaw fetched the revolver from the lake, and Julian managed to bring the fireplace poker to the kitchen and seemed to be all right, had even regained his color. Then Vicky landed on another question mark and drew a card that said, "A predator blocks your path. The next player chooses the predator." Aggie was the next player and didn't hesitate. She grabbed the businessman with the briefcase and set him on the square right in front of Teeny Vicky, the square that had the garrote next to it. Julian leaped up and ran for the nearest bathroom. Conan and Cougar looked at Julian's empty place at the table, then looked at the board. Grimshaw counted the seconds. When a full minute had passed, he rose casually.
"I'll go check on him,"
Make sure he's all right. Hope he's not coming down with a stomach bug.
Following Vicky's directions, he found the powder room and knocked on the door.
Julian?
He didn't hear vomiting. Didn't hear anything. He turned the knob and was surprised it wasn't locked. He opened the door a couple of inches.
Julian? I'm all right.
Grimshaw opened the door a bit more and leaned in. Seeing Julian bent over the sink, face dripping with water, he squeezed into the room and closed the door.
What happened? Not now, Wayne. Not here.
Julian straightened and wiped his face with the hand towel. Let's finish the game and get out of here.
Are you reacting to the game?
Julian hesitated.
I hope so.
He studied his friend.
But you don't think so? No,
Julian said grimly.
I don't think so.
They returned to the social room and the game. Julian made excuses for his hasty retreat. Grimshaw didn't know if Vicky believed him, but she pretended to, and the others followed her example. Figuring out the solution was a bit slapdash, but they finished the game and said their goodbyes. Are you sure you're all right? Vicky asked.
I'm fine, Julian replied. Thanks for the interesting evening.
He ran to the car.
I'll persuade him to stay at any case, Grimshaw said, in case he does have a touch of something.
And if he couldn't persuade Julian to stay at any case, he'd sleep on his friend's couch at the cabin. One way or another, Julian wasn't going to be alone tonight.
I'll call tomorrow, Vicky said.
As they approached the intersection, Grimshaw said,
Which way? To your cabin or to Sproing?
Neither,
Julian replied.
Pull over here. Put your lights on so we don't get rear-ended.
Not sure of the condition of the shoulder, Grimshaw eased the right side tires off the road and turned on the cruiser's flashing lights. Julian punched a number into his mobile phone. Grimshaw was surprised that it worked, but the storm was spent and would be cleared out by morning.
This is Julian Farrow. Grimshaw and I were at the jumble, and we're heading back to Sproing. I need to see you. Now.
He waited until Julian finished the call.
Before you put that away, call Inike and see if she's got a room.
Julian stared out the window for a minute, then called Inike and arranged to stay at the boarding house overnight. Grimshaw didn't see another car on the road, didn't see anything approach his car. But a few minutes after Julian made the first call, the back door opened and Ilya Sanguinati slipped inside.
Is this a typical kind of meeting for humans? Ilya asked.
Sometimes,
Julian replied,
when there is a need for secrecy.
And what secrets are we sharing?
Julian turned in his seat in order to look at Ilya.
What happened tonight has never happened to me before, so I can't give you any assurance that what I sensed is accurate.
Understood.
No questions from the Sanguinati about how or why Julian sensing something would be significant, which meant Ilya, at least, knew Julian wasn't into it.
A predator in a business suit is going to come to the jumble, Julian said. Maybe more than one. When that happens, you need to get Vicky Devine out of there. Not just have her stay with you, or at any case while she fights to hold on to that place. You have to go along with whatever scam the predators are going to play and make them believe they succeeded in taking the jumble away from her.
Silence. His eyes fixed on the rearview mirror. Grimshaw saw the cold look on Ilya's face and wondered if Julian realized how close he was to being killed. How close they both were.
And why should I do that?
The Sanguinati finally asked. Julian looked Ilya in the eyes.
If you don't, Vicky Devine is going to die.
Chapter 38. Vicky. Wednesday, June 28th. I sat in Inike's kitchen and watched her cut up carrots for the Sproingers while I sorted out the order of the things I wanted to discuss.
Should I start with the good news that had some concerns, or the development that had me more than a little concerned? Good news could wait. Julian and Grimshaw are acting weird.
They're men,
Inike replied. That's normal.